Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, Arizona's law is preliminarily ruled unconstitutional. What a shock. The governor's appealing. Well, she's actually not appealing at all, but she's appealing the ruling. For the second time in a month, a financial giant agrees to pay a fine without admitting wrongdoing. Last time it was Goldman Sachs, this time it's Citigroup. Let's talk about avoiding consent decrees. Amazon announces a new version of the Kindle e-book reader to come out in late August for only $189. Care to guess on what percentage of Americans have purchased an e-book? Okay, we'll tell you. It's 9%. But more people are buying e-books from Amazon than are buying hardcovers. Reportedly, Sarah Palin isn't reading anything, but one of her daughters uses the Nook e-reader. You asked for it, they recalled it. Toyota has recalled over 400,000 Avalon models, not for sudden acceleration, but for steering problems. Even its name is turning into a problem. And its luxury nameplate, Lexus, has also been the subject of a recall for steering issues. Some good news. Shirley Sherrod, the USDA employee who was wrongly accused of racism, has decided to sue Andrew Breitbart. He still hasn't said he was wrong. Here's the question of the day. Is this man a racist or just an idiot? A new study in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests you don't need your mouth to save a life. We can all think of times when it may have saved ours, but that's not what we're talking about. We'll explain that. A new study from New Zealand suggests that those who take calcium supplements to remedy or prevent osteoporosis, after being told they're at risk for it, there is a 30% greater likelihood to experience an MI. MI is a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. Usually, of course, when you hear a story like this, you're told to check with your doctor. But before you ask your doctor whether you should stop taking calcium, why don't you ask her or him first if she or he has any familiarity with the study? If not, why would you ask a medical question of someone who's less knowledgeable than you are? A bill to legalize internet gambling has just cleared a House committee. Now you won't have to leave your house to lose your house. I wonder if that's deductible. We weren't the only ones to report on this story, but with regard to the overpriced city manager and other officials in Bell, California, I should say overcompensated, but now they have resigned. The citizens there, however, are not done. They're filing a lawsuit, among other things, to try to withdraw the pension to which the city manager is legally, though probably not morally, entitled, in the amount of over $600,000 a year. Democracy actually does work. New jobless claims and the four-week moving average of new jobless claims both dropped last week, more than expected. Some are predicting a new dip in housing, but at the same time, toxic assets that the government bought from AIG and Bear Stearns have gone up in value by $2 billion in the last quarter. Granted, when it comes to recessions, Yogi Berra was right. It ain't over till it's over. But still, now, there's a product out there called K2. No, not KY, that's for something else. But K2 is a synthetic marijuana that's been legal in most states. There are a couple of problems. First, the substance has caused a large number of people to end up in emergency rooms, complaining of heart palpitations and extreme anxiety. Second, many states are moving to make it illegal, as they clearly should. Third, this heretofore legal substance doesn't produce the same kind of high as the actual drug. Marijuana, of course. So why use a synthetic? If you don't know how to get grass, ask a kid. Even if the kid doesn't smoke grass, she or he is almost certain to know where it's available. Marijuana after this should have an advertising slogan that's no longer used by another product. It's the real thing. I mean, think about the other product that used to use it. It was Coke. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me, or I. All that, news of the weird, and our guest, author Vicki Liskey, to talk about her book, Kindle as a Publishing Medium, and much more. But first, Our book, The Mobile Millionaire, is available, and excerpts are readable thereon at a website called MobileMillionaire, all one word, .blogspot.com. The book deals with mobile home investment as a way of gaining income and wealth, and it was written by this humble reporter. And if you'd like to look at an excerpt, you can do so on the site. And if you decide you want to obtain the book, you can do it there as well. We wanted to talk about those news stories, and we will do that. But first, wanted to invite you, if you wish to call in. Most people who listen to this show prefer to just listen, for reasons that escape me, but they prefer to just listen. And if you want to do that, that's fine. But if you want to call in and participate, either on any of the topics we've discussed or on the subjects of writing, publishing, Kindle, ebook readers, and so forth, please feel free to do that. The number here is 347-994-3796. Another story that came out today was that an international group of scientists has found that there is virtually no question anymore. The Earth is getting warmer, and that's overall. And additionally, the climate is changing, more importantly, over a broad swath of the Earth. And where we are here in Arizona, you don't have to read a study. You can go outside. Now, the fact is that any one year or one season proves nothing, and there are always aberrations in climate from year to year. But last year was the warmest year since they've been keeping records of temperature. The fact is that the increase from one year to the next, or one year is against another, is not that great, thankfully. But the Earth was warmer last year than any prior year in history. But when speaking about climate change here, we've been in Arizona for 30 years and change. And I will tell you that this summer is the most humid we have ever had. And last year was about the second most humid we've ever had. Again, 2 years does not a proof of climate change make. But the reality is everybody here in the Phoenix metro area says the same thing, i.e. that this is the worst in terms of humidity. Now, you may wonder, why is humidity a big deal in as contrasted with other places? Well, in the summer here, as most of you know, it tends to get into the 100-degree range, 100, 105, 110. And normally, when it is not the so-called monsoon season, that's not terrible. It's not great if you don't like heat, but it's not terrible. But when you add about 30% humidity, when it's normally about 4, it's extraordinarily uncomfortable. It's probably equivalent to the 90 degrees and 90% humidity they have in certain parts of the Middle West. And this is appearing to be a change. So for what it's worth, there you are. By the way, there was earlier a rainstorm where we are, and I've seen some lights flickering. So hopefully we'll be able to go for the full hour tonight. But if we suddenly go off, it was because we had a power failure. We haven't had it yet, and I'm hoping we won't. Anyway, speaking of Arizona, the infamous law that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, SB 1070, was, as almost everybody in the world now knows, ruled essentially unconstitutional. In theory, the judge, the U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton, only knocked out certain parts of it, but it was as close to being all of it as would be possible to do without declaring the entire thing unconstitutional. The decision itself, which runs about 26 pages, is available broadly on the internet. You can read it for yourself if you're so inclined. But the essence of it is that a state cannot make rules and laws regarding immigration, naturalization, and so forth, because it's the sole province of the federal government, what might be called in some context the central government, because the entire government, state and national, is the federal government in one sense under the Constitution. But what we now call the federal government has sole jurisdiction over that subject area, and therefore states can't govern in that area according to the decision, even if the federal government has failed to do a particularly good job, which in fact is the case. We talked briefly in the headline about Citigroup. Citigroup agreed to pay some money without admitting they were wrong. They were accused of not correctly disclosing to their investors, those who bought their stock, with regard to what their exposure was to subprime loan defaults. They said it was one figure, and it turned out to be four times as great. And in the process of the Securities and Exchange Commission investigating them and trying to get them to acknowledge wrongdoing, an agreement was reached whereby Citigroup, without admitting wrongdoing, is paying out some fines. Prior to that, Goldman Sachs did the same thing. The problem with consent decrees is that it doesn't do anything in the sense that it doesn't have an organization, a company, admit they were wrong. There is something to be said for these companies admitting wrongdoing. And my opinion, although I understand the reason for a consent decree, which is where they say, we don't admit we did anything wrong, but we're paying the fine, and by the way, we'll never do it again. The fact is, not admitting they were wrong limits their exposure to criminal prosecution. There ought to be a methodology where they could admit they were wrong and not face criminal prosecution necessarily and pay a fine, but please, let them admit they were wrong. They cheated their investors, and they need to admit that. Enough for the soapbox on that subject. We talked about Toyota. By the way, they recalled a bunch of vehicles about a year ago, I guess, for unexpected sudden acceleration, and they went back a few years and did that. But there have been a number of stories, and I know of people who have older Toyotas who have had the same problem, and they didn't recall all those cars. Toyota needs some more responsibility. The recall of the cars with the steering problem happened a week before they were due to answer questions in front of Congress about reports of steering problems in those cars. So what they've done now is less responsible and more an attempt to avoid the appearance of guilt by not producing. Shirley Sherrod, the employee who was fired from the United States Department of Agriculture and has since been offered another job, who hasn't decided whether to take it or not. This was after she was forced to resign as Director of Rural Development following the release of a tape which was edited, and what was edited out was how she came to avoid her own internal racist feelings and help white farmers retain or get back their land. And the reason that the story came out was once the full tape was shown, because it still was available, it made it very clear that Sherrod was being anything but racist. She was being anti-racist. And Breitbart had released the recording without that part of the speech that she made before the NAACP. Breitbart says he released the tape to show that the NAACP, which had called for the Tea Party movement to reject racists among them, had racists of their own, that is the NAACP. And the NAACP, in a defensive move, when they saw the recording as had been edited by Breitbart, called for Sherrod's resignation as well, said it was shameful, and so on and so forth. Once the recording was released in its full version, the NAACP apologized, the administration apologized, and the Department of Agriculture offered Sherrod a job. The one person in this whole mess that hasn't apologized and hasn't admitted he's wrong is Andrew Breitbart. And now Sherrod has decided to sue him. And I say good for her. Now, the truth is, I can't tell you that she's going to win in a lawsuit. One concern with regard to that would be that it would be difficult to demonstrate financial damage, and in the absence of that, there may be difficulty proving other damages that may have occurred, but that's what she's doing, and I say hurrah. Excuse me. We talked about the study that was released in the New England Journal of Medicine saying you don't need your mouth to save a life. They didn't exactly say that. It's just more interesting to say it like that. But what they are talking about is that according to all of the recent study, hands-only CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, is as effective as the traditional CPR where you pump someone's chest and breathe in their mouth for them. It may not be as romantic, but it's probably a lot more sanitary. It's certainly a lot more sanitary, and more importantly, it's just as effective, and some people believe more effective. And that's the reason for that is that if you are breathing for someone too, and if it's only one person doing the CPR, you may not be able to do as much pumping, in part because you get tired because of the breathing and so forth. But there is a website, and I believe it is called handsonlycpr.org. And if I'm wrong, I apologize, but if you put handsonlycpr as one word into Google search, you will find it, and they will talk about handsonlycpr, and I think you'll find that interesting if you're interested in the subject at all. We talked about the study. Oh, by the way, the phone number, again, 347-994-3796. In about 9 minutes, we'll be joined by Vicki Liske, who will talk about her writing and her publication history, and specifically as it relates to Kindle and online publishing. We started to talk a moment ago, or re-talk, about the study from New Zealand. People who apparently take supplementary calcium are at a greater risk, and particularly men, by the way, are at even greater risk than women, are at greater risk, according to this study, of having a heart attack. This is crazy. I mean, the study, I'm pretty sure, is probably right. I don't have any knowledge, but I'm guessing it's probably accurate. But the whole concept of taking supplementary calcium to prevent osteoporosis, this is another reason not to do it. But there's a pretty good one before this. It's almost completely ineffective. The studies demonstrate that if you take calcium to help prevent osteoporosis, it doesn't do you any good and may, in fact, do you some harm. A better substance to take, according to some of those studies, is something called silica. You can look into that on your own. But here's an interesting question for you. If you've been listening to this show for a long time, you know we've mentioned this before, but take stock of the fact that the country in which there is the most osteoporosis is also the country in which there is the most dairy product, that is cow's milk, consumption, and consumption of supplemental calcium. Okay, so if in this country we're referring to, more people take more calcium in than any other country, why would they also have the largest incidence of osteoporosis? There is some argument that that calcium consumption actually may help lead to more osteoporosis. That's not proven, but there is that speculation. That country, by the way, in case you haven't guessed, and I'm guessing you have, is the United States. That's what we have. We have the most osteoporosis and the most calcium consumption and dairy product consumption of anywhere in the world. And if you believe that calcium helps prevent osteoporosis, that does not square with that belief. I made a joke of sorts, about, not a very good one particularly, about the loss of one's house through internet gambling. That, by the way, cleared the House Finance Committee, chaired by Congressman Barney Frank, and is now going to the full House, and if they ever vote on it, presumably it'll pass, because it passed with bipartisan support out of the committee. Internet gambling is currently illegal in the United States, which isn't to say no one does it. But the interesting thing is that a couple of years ago happened, is all of the banks, I believe being pushed by the government, determined that you cannot use your credit card. You can't use a U.S. credit card. This may have changed. It's not something I follow. You couldn't use a U.S. credit card like a Visa or a MasterCard to engage in internet gambling. They blocked you if you were going to do that. I, again, don't know what the story is now. But this bill, if passed by the House and the Senate and signed by the President, would make it no longer illegal, which is kind of a good thing, because that would mean that these internet gambling organizations would actually locate here and pay taxes here. Right now, there are still people doing internet gambling all over the world, and the internet gambling sites just got out of the United States. The internet being what it is, you can operate from anywhere. If you have your house foreclosed, and as a result of that, you no longer owe your mortgage, that, although there's legislation to prevent it, that has a negative tax consequence. The amount of the loan that's forgiven can be counted as income that you have to pay tax on. But the question in my mind, even though it's ridiculous and facetious, when I stated it earlier, is if you lose your house in terms of gambling, is it deductible? Gambling losses, of course, are only deductible against gambling gains, but it's an interesting, probably solely academic question. We often report on news of the weird here, and you might think that the story we told about the synthetic marijuana falls into that category. But the website we go to is one where they do they do a column that appears in some newspapers around the country. It's News of the Weird, and the website is newsoftheweird.blogspot.com. I commend it to you, recommend it to you as an interesting place to go. We have a few stories to talk about. Okay, some of this is less than perfectly appetizing, but I'll share them with you anyway. The first one, in particular, a senior embalmer at the Memphis Funeral Home saved the tools he used in 1977 on the embalming of Elvis Presley. He's going to offer them at auction in August. This includes the rubber gloves, the forceps, the lip brushes, the comb, and the eyeliner. August, Memphis, line up now. Another story that you may find interesting, a gentleman by the name of Horatio Touré was arrested in San Francisco approximately 10 minutes after he allegedly stole a cell phone from a woman. She was only there, or where she was, because she was testing her company's GPS tracking system. I'm laughing because a moment ago we just lost our switchboard from the internet, so we have to go ahead and log back in. I'm assuming you're still hearing me, but without that switchboard available, we can't bring in any callers, so we're going to go ahead, including our guest, so we're going to go ahead and log back in. In any event, so she was testing the GPS system on the phone, and after he stole it, they determined it worked. They were able to find him. So there you have it. And let's try that again. We are experiencing a minor technical difficulty, that being that the website of Blog Talk Radio momentarily has lost our switchboard for us, so we are logging back in. And here is the switchboard now. Good. Okay, we're back. And I don't know if that lost any sound on the program, but if it did, as I said, we're back. And we are in a moment going to have Vicki Liskey with us to talk about her book and writing. And you're welcome to join us now or then at 347-994-3796. Another story that came from News of the Weird, Anthony Julies was in the magistrate's court in Cape Town, South Africa. I have mixed feelings about this story, by the way. I'm not sure I should go ahead and share it with you, but it's also funny and it's also disgusting. He was caught having sex with a neighbor's poodle. He didn't stop even after the neighbors gathered around to shame him because he said it wasn't right to start something and then stop. And he might have hurt the poodle's feelings, I suppose. He also said the dog mustn't flaunt herself like that. Okay. Last week, as you know, we did the show remotely from Laughlin, Nevada. And at that time, we had an interview with my lovely bride, Alicia. And we also obviously talked about a great many stories. This story is actually left over from that show. We didn't get a chance to deliver it because we had so many news stories to talk about. And, of course, the interview. A gentleman in Springfield, Massachusetts, Manuel Lefty Hernandez of Springfield, Massachusetts, was charged with snatching a man's wallet, undoubtedly with his left hand, as that's the only one he has. Police would have charged him with a felony if he had had a weapon, but they said he was unarmed. And that's our News of the Weird for the week. Again, we're at 347-994-3796. We have another writer joining us next week, and then at the end of August for our anniversary show, we are going to be joined again by Larry Hancock. And And we're going to talk more about politics, assassinations, and so forth. I also want to thank those of you who have been joining us week after week. Our listenership, again, for reasons that I'm not sure of, continues to grow, and we appreciate that. So if you don't like the show, of course, you can send us a note. If you do like it, as they used to say in an old TV commercial, tell a friend. At this point, if the technology is working, I'm going to try to bring into the show Vicki Liske. Vicki, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just perfectly. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Every time I press that button on the site, I'm always worried it's not going to work.
I understand.
But it
completely.
Did. Yeah.
Awesome.
I don't know if you've been listening to the show, but a moment ago, lost the switchboard on the website.
Yes, I heard
Well, if you heard it, then we didn't apparently lose the program. Thank you.
You didn't lose the program. No, I heard it, so that was good.
Okay. Very good. Good. Well, Vicki is an author. I would like you to tell us about the book you have recently done.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about its publishing in a few minutes, but I also want to talk to you about some of your other writing. So first, talk to us about the book you just did. What was it?
Wonderful. It's a book called Not What She Seems, and it's a romantic suspense novel. And mm-hmm. basically the idea I had for writing it was a rich businessman meets a woman on the run. And that was my mm-hmm. basic concept for the book, and I just sort of took off with writing it from there. And you've got a woman who's running from the police and a billionaire who falls in love with her, and it sort of just kind of gets tangled up in her life. And it's a mystery and mm-hmm. a suspense novel, and it's got a little romance in it. So it's kind of all three all mixed into one.
That's great. And it appeals to, obviously, a variety of audiences, because there are mystery fans, suspense fans, who are really the same, and romance fans who may not be the same group. So I guess it's what they call in music a crossover.
Yes, it is.
Definitely. Okay. And tell us about your previous writing history.
Well, you know what? This is my first book I've ever written, and mm-hmm. I've always started writing novels and never really got around to finishing them. You know, I'd write a few pages and it just sort of got put aside. And mm-hmm. I injured my back a few years back, and I couldn't do anything. Literally, I could not move. So I decided mm-hmm. right then and there I was going to finish that novel, because I could put my laptop on my stomach and just type away, and I couldn't couldn't feed the kids or do anything. So my husband had to take over all that, and I basically just for a whole week just typed on my computer. And so I wrote the first draft right there in a week.
You wrote a draft in a week of a full novel? How long is the novel?
The novel is 67,000 words long, so about 300 and some odd pages.
And you did that draft in a week. That's amazing.
I did. And it actually was a little bit shorter. That first draft, it was about 50,000 words. But that still is kind of amazing to do in a week.
Okay.
I do know other authors who, they take part in NaNoWriMo, if you've ever heard of that. That's the novel in November. It's NaNoWriMo. It stands for National... something about writing in a month, but you take November and you write a whole novel. Yes.
I remember it's a contest of some sort, and it's on the web.
It is, definitely. And people join up, and it's kind of a honor system. So if you finish a whole novel in November, then you can go in and say, hey, I did it, and they give you kudos for doing it. And I know several people who go on there and they say, well, I want to write three novels in November. So they'll make that goal and they'll finish it, which is astounding to me. But
me too. But okay, so instead of a laptop, you wrote on your tummy top.
I did.
And you knocked off that draft in a week. Okay, and then of course you continue to work on it, edit it, make some changes.
Definitely.
All told, about how long did it take you to write this?
About 3 to 4 years till it was ready for publication, because I really didn't know whatever I was doing when I started. I just said, I want to write a novel. And I had no idea, no concept of what makes a good novel. So the first thing I did when I finished it was I decided to see if it was any good. And so I posted to a critique group and got some other authors' opinions and suggestions, and I found out I really didn't know a whole lot about it. So there was a lot I needed to tweak in it.
Well, but it's a learning experience, obviously.
Definitely.
To do any kind of writing. Right.
Definitely.
Had you previously done, besides attempts at novels, had you previously done some work in terms of magazines or newspapers or organizational writing?
No, definitely nothing at all. I'm a creative person. I have a graphic design background, but I really haven't done any writing prior to this book.
Okay, well, that's sensational and amazing, because most people who write novels come from at least, I mean, most people who write, as you know, have a lot of stuff in the drawers, you know, whether it's like in your 2 pages or 10 pages of previous effort, you know, on a number of aborted efforts, or they have, in some cases, full novels in drawers that will never see the light of publication because they know for their for themselves that they stink. And additionally, a lot of people who write novels, of course, have written nonfiction books or who have written magazine articles, or, you know, and the novel is what they finally achieve after doing this. And you went, you know, it's kind of like running for the office of the presidency without having held a previous office, which is great, but and very interesting. Now, you chose a rather unusual publication path, and I will share with you that the questions I'm going to ask you about that publication path are both interesting to me and I think to our audience, but I also, to be honest with you and to our audience, I'm kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? I have my own ulterior motive, as I've written a book that is on the web, and I'm thinking of following your path. So some of those questions may sound self-centered.
No problem. Feel free.
Okay, so talk about what you did first. In terms of publishing the book, and before you do that, and before we reveal that to our audience, how many books have you sold thus far?
I am about 5 books away from 800 sold.
Okay, now some of our audience won't realize that that's an accomplishment, and I'm not talking about because of the way you published it. No, I'm serious, because they think that everybody who writes a book and publishes it in some form or another sells 10,000 books.
Yeah.
Tell us what the truth of the matter is, because I know you know that.
It is very difficult to sell over 1,000 copies of a book. 93% of all published books sell less than 1,000 copies. So
93% sell less than 1,000. So if I write a book and get it somehow miraculously published, or I self-publish, you know, and print it, whether I get it into bookstores or not.
Yes.
The likelihood is that 93 to 7, if you will, that I will sell less or fewer, I should say, than 1,000 copies.
Yes, it is staggering.
Amazing.
The statistics are staggering against authors, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So now talk to us about how you decided to publish your book.
I went ahead and published my book by myself through the Kindle, and I did that in late April. And basically, all I had to do was log in and say that, yes, this text belongs to me, and upload it through the Kindle website and create a cover design for it and upload that, and boom, it was done. I did it in 1 hour.
Okay, that's terrific. All right, now, so we know, and again, in my case, so I know.
Yeah.
First off, I must tell you, and this I assume you know, but you may not, and likewise some of our audience may not know, books that typically sell on the Internet, you are told, if you're going to sell, or just self-publishing generally, you're told that if you're going to self-publish, do a nonfiction book, because those sell better in terms of nonfiction, in terms
of
self-publishing.
That's what I've been
told. Yeah.
That's what I've been told.
Because novels, particularly first novels, by a writer, someone who has not had a published novel before. I mean, if Stephen King decided to do what you did, he'd sell, you know, 1 million copies, not because his writing is necessarily better than yours, but because he's well-known, okay? So if you're unknown, which you admittedly were at the beginning of this, the idea of selling 995, what did you say, you're 5 short of 1,000, 995 books?
Five short of 800.
Of 800, I beg your pardon.
the way I'm selling now, by the end of August, I should be at 1,000.
Amazing. Okay. So, and by the way, for you said you did this at the beginning of April?
Yes.
Okay. For those of you who are listening to us in archive edition, the date today is July 29th, just so it's clear. Okay.
Yes.
Now, so you went ahead. Now, what's the website you went to upload your book?
You know, I searched Kindle DTP.
Okay.
It is the Amazon digital text platform. And if
okay.
you search Amazon DTP or Kindle DTP, that'll get you
You'll find
the
it.
Website.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you uploaded it. Now, your book had to be in PDF form, did it?
It was actually in a Microsoft Word document.
Okay.
And
right.
I saved it as a web page unfiltered is how I saved
okay.
it. And that's
okay.
what got the formatting the best.
So web page unfiltered, which is something you can do in Word
yes.
when it's a save as,
yes.
there is something on there to allow you to do that. And then you uploaded it,
yes.
and then you uploaded at more or less the same time a cover separate from the book being uploaded,
yes.
the text being uploaded.
Exactly.
And there it is. And then
there it is.
What did you do next?
Then I went on to kindleboards.com. It's a forum.
Okay.
And it's where all the Kindle users hang out and talk to each other, and a lot of other indie authors hang out and talk to each other. And I just introduced myself and started talking with everybody else, and all of a sudden my book started selling.
Okay, so the first thing is I want to mention is those of you who have a Kindle or don't and just want to go there and chat, you can go to kindleboards.com,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Okay, and you'll see some of the things that are going on there. And also, if you are an author and you go through this process of uploading your book, you would go there and basically start participating in the forums,
yes.
Or probably more correctly in English, the fora. But in the forum,
yes, that's right.
But in the forums, and by so doing, when you're communicating with these folks, you're talking about what your book is about and seeing where you know and determining and trying to pump up the interest.
Yes, and they allow you over on the Kindle boards to start one thread to
mm-hmm.
promote your own book, and you can
right.
you can post to it once a week so that it bumps up to the top of all the threads. And
wow.
So mostly what you're doing instead of promoting your own book, mostly what you're doing is just chatting with other people, and they allow you to put a little picture of your book in your sig line. Down at the bottom.
Wow.
And it links right to your book. So if you're chatting about frogs or whatever, people can see, hey, she's got a book out, you know, and click on it. And the best thing you can do is just be active and talk to other people. And the more people get to know you on there, the more they're going to be interested in your book.
Okay. And, of course, you can also put a in your signature in your normal email that you sent to everybody else in the world that you know.
Definitely.
And by the way, when someone wants to get to your book specifically in Kindle, is there, and I didn't prepare you for this, so, you know, it may be an unfair question, but if someone wanted to go see your book specifically on Kindle
yeah.
boards.com or, okay, is there a specific website that they would type into their browser, or do they just go to kindleboards.com and search?
You can do a search in kindleboards.com. If you want
mm-hmm.
to take a peek at my book and my description, I'd just go over to amazon.com and
mm-hmm.
type in Not What She Seems. That's the title, and it should come right up.
Okay, so in other words, once you do this, and I failed to mention something which is vital here, and I apologize,
sure.
is when you decided to do this, you did it only in this form. You didn't publish a hardcover version or a paperback version. The only way one can get this book, as of the moment at least, is through Kindle boards and Amazon, correct?
That was true last month. At the beginning
okay.
of this month, I did go ahead. I was having requests for a paperback version as people got
wow.
to know me and noticed that my
wanted
book was out
it.
And they wanted to read it, and they didn't have a
yeah.
Kindle. They started saying, hey, are you ever going to put out in paperback? So
right.
I did go ahead, and I went on to CreateSpace and put my book up. But I do want to stress that as an independent author or as a self-published author, the
uh-huh.
money is not going to come from paperback sales, because I've sold 13 paperbacks as opposed to over 750 ebooks on the Kindle.
Right. Well, let me come back to that too. CreateSpace.com is basically an on-demand publisher.
That's true.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So no, I'm asking. I don't know. So you didn't have to pay for printing a lot of books. You only order a print of a book when someone orders it, or they can order
it.
That is correct. Okay. And so what you're saying is that's as the old song goes, that ain't the way to have fun. It's through Kindle boards and Amazon.
That is true. And you can do it. I mean, it's great to see your book in a paperback form. It's wonderful. It's something you can hold in your hand. But don't expect all your sales to come from that. I would definitely, and it just makes sense when somebody's taking a chance on a brand new author. Are they going to spend $2.99 on, you know, taking a chance on a book, or are they going to spend $15 to $20 on a paperback and then plus shipping and handling?
Physical book.
Get it to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which gets me to the point that I was going to go to next anyway. Is that's what they call a good segue. And that is talking about pricing the books. By the way, I know what your next book should be.
Oh, what should it be?
It should be How to Publish Your Book on Kindle.
There you go. Perfect.
And I'm sure I'm not the only person who suggested that to you, but I think that has a real market.
That is a good idea.
Okay. In any event, what I was going to ask you is talking about pricing. Now, pricing a book, everyone thinks their book ought to sell for $19.95. And thousands of people ought to line up to buy it. Because we all, I mean, one of the things is, and I write too, obviously, from as you got from our conversation and in our previous correspondence, the fact is you cannot perform a more egotistical act, and that's not a criticism of you, obviously. A more egotistical act than writing a book and then offering for sale and think that someone's going to want to buy it. The fortunate thing is that for some people, it becomes less a matter of ego because there are people who actually do want to buy it, and then word of mouth is created, and they tell somebody else about the book, and there it is, so that they can have it. Now, I want to talk to you about the pricing, and I want to talk to you about the concern about stealing, okay?
Yeah.
So talk to me first about pricing. You said you priced your book at $2.99, right?
It's at $2.99 right now. For the first 2 months, it was at $1.99, and
okay.
I did that as low as I could go, and you can price it at 99 cents if you want to, because Amazon allows you to price it that
way. Right.
But I wanted to price it lower and still make somewhat of a royalty on it. So I went ahead and did it for $1.99 for the first 2 months to get some interest in it. And at the beginning of July, I don't know if you know this, but Amazon restructured their royalties.
No.
Uh-huh. So in the beginning of July, what they did was they said all books that are priced, all e-books that are priced between $2.99 and $9.99 get a 70% royalty.
Great.
Which is huge. It's huge.
Sure.
And so that means by raising my price for $1, I instead of getting 70 cents from the $1.99,
sure,
I now get over $2, just a little bit over $2 per book that I sell.
Great.
Which is absolutely huge.
Yeah, it is, because if you sell a book for $19.95 in a bookstore published by a commercial publisher, you're not going to get nearly that much.
That's true.
So, yeah, so you're miles ahead with a lower price, and obviously your readers are ahead. So you have it at $2.99, and even, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that $2.99 would be a barrier to anybody who wants to just take it. And these people buy it through Amazon, so they use their credit card.
Yes.
Or PayPal, and everybody's happy. So, and you don't have to deal with that because Amazon presumably sends you a check, what, once a month or something?
They do, yes.
Yeah, okay. And this, you know, I've got to tell you, it sounds great because it's kind of a no-lose proposition. It doesn't cost you anything to put it up, right?
Doesn't cost a thing.
Wow, amazing. Okay. By the way, in the minutes we have remaining, if you wish to speak with Vicki and me, or just Vicki for that matter, I can shut up. you can reach us at 347-994-3796. And if you just want to sit and listen, that's fine too. If you're listening to us in archive edition, of course you can't call, but I should tell you we're on Thursday nights from 7:30 to 8:30 Pacific time. And of course you're not in Pacific, so you're staying up late for us, and we appreciate it.
No problem at all.
All right, now you've had conversation with other folks who have been doing the same thing, right?
Yes, I have, definitely. There are quite a few authors who are jumping on board. And sorry, did you have a question?
No. Well, you answered one of them. That's all right. But the follow-up question was, how are they doing? I mean, is there something? I mean, yes, there's something unique about your book, obviously. Excuse me. But the question is, how are other folks doing in terms of actually selling books through this methodology?
You know, there's a wide variety out there, and some of it depends on cover design.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it depends on marketing. And some of it depends on how well the book is written. You can't, you know, take a book that's poorly written and try and market it and be successful at it. So there's a wide variety.
The expression is lipstick on a pig.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, go. But go
but
ahead.
I
what
do
you were
know
saying,
some
please.
Authors who are doing much better than I'm doing. Vicki Tiley was, she got an agent and. Her agent took her book to the New York publishers, and they turned it down. They all said, nobody wants to read a mystery that's in Australia. That's where the setting was.
Okay.
They said, nobody wants to read that. So he suggested she put it up on the Kindle herself. She priced it at 99 cents, which means she got 35 cents off of every book that sold. She sold over 20,000 e-books in a few months' time. I think it was 2 months. And she made it to number one on the Kindle Mysteries bestseller list. And, you know, she was only making 35 cents per ebook that sold, but that's $7,000.
I was going to say, if you're selling 20,000, 35 cents a shot is not bad.
Not bad. Not bad. And Karen McQuestion has been selling on the Kindle for 11 months, and she sold over 36,000 ebooks. And she did get a film option on one of her books with a Hollywood producer from just all the attention she was getting with her Kindle sales.
Well, you know, the future is now.
It really is.
Yeah, you know, we've been, people who have been around the fringes of the publishing industry, which includes me, for a number of years, have been talking for a long time about the fact that the time was going to come when you could do digital books, do it easily. Now, and here's the other thing. I was going to ask you about stealing, and I will do that, but
yes.
The only people who can actually download these books, am I right, are people who have the Kindle, or can other people download them too?
Anybody can download them if you have a computer, because they have a free computer application called Kindle for PC. Which allows you
to buy
any of these Kindle books, which is wonderful because it opens up the market to a lot of people.
Absolutely. And so, and if I were to download your book on my PC, because I don't have a Kindle, I have a Kindle, but I don't have a Kindle. Anyway, but if I were to do that, and I could print it out on paper of my own, were I so inclined, right?
If you know how to do it. I think it's protected to a certain extent from printing it out. I'm sure there's a way to, you know, manipulate the file if you're computer-wise. I'm not, but I'm sure there's a way to do that.
Well, no, I wasn't talking about printing it out for purposes of copyright infringement. I was talking about it in terms of if I wanted to read your book, but I didn't want to necessarily sit at my computer. I wanted to, you know, carry it around with me and so forth without buying the paperback. You're saying that it's not really designed to do that. The real design.
It's not really designed to do that.
Computer.
Yeah, it's mostly designed
or
to read
Kindle.
On your computer or your Kindle.
Gotcha. Okay. Now the next question is when you're talking about someone being able to download your book, right?
Yeah.
Is it protected in such a way that, let's say, Harry down the street downloads your book or Vicky's book, one of the other people you mentioned, the other Vicky, I should say.
Yeah.
Or Karen. Is there some way that Harry down the street could then, again, without being a computer geek, could easily send it to me? Or is it protected such that they can only effectively download it and read it? They can't necessarily send it. Do you know?
It depends on the author and the publisher, because when I put my book up on Amazon, it asked me if I wanted to protect it, and you can choose to protect it or you can choose to not protect it.
And your choice was?
I did go ahead and protect it. After speaking with Kindle users, I decided that probably wasn't the best thing for the user. Because
okay.
if you buy 100 books for your Kindle and then a year later decide that you would like a Nook instead,
mm-hmm.
you can't easily convert those.
Transfer. Okay.
Yeah, you can't transfer to another system. It's
right.
a lot harder for the user. And I'm one who thinks that most people are pretty honest. Most people are going to go ahead and buy your book instead of steal it. So
mm-hmm.
I probably won't with the next one.
Okay, all right. And so if you're suggesting if you don't protect it, it's easier for someone to transfer it from the Kindle to the Nook or some other system, or just as is there some other reason why it's better to not protect it?
That would be the only reason I can think of
okay.
why you wouldn't want to protect
it. I
gotcha.
I gotcha. And, of course, most of the books that Kindles that are sold for the Kindle are protected because they are traditionally published books.
Yeah.
So the publisher is going to protect it. But you're suggesting that if you're a self-publishing author publishing on Kindle exclusively, you're probably better off not protecting it.
You know, it does make it more attractive to the people who buy it.
Sure.
And you do get more sales.
And I'll tell you something else. Siri, as a reader, you know, the idea of, and I haven't done this yet, but the idea of going to a place where I can download to my computer a book for $1.99
yeah.
and read it, that's, you know, especially if it's in a genre that I want to read, you know, or, you know, or an author I want to read, that's
yeah.
like extraordinarily appealing. How could you not want to buy a book that sounds even remotely appealing? Do you have like a blurb on the site that describes what's in the book as you did a moment ago when we first started talking?
I do, yes. When you put your book up on Amazon, it asks you for a short description. So you can put your
mm-hmm.
little teaser blurb on there. And one of the best things about selling on the Kindle is that users can go in and download a sample so they get the first 10% of the book on their Kindle, and they can read it. And if they get hooked in that sample, they can just click and buy it right then and there.
Sounds fabulous. It really
yeah.
does. It sounds like the way lots of things are going to go. I can almost guarantee you what's going. You know, they talk about the fact that the Kindle is going to reach a price point. Not just the Kindle, but the other readers as well are going to reach a price point where everybody wants one. Okay.
Yes.
They're
and
not there yet.
I don't know. Did you know they just announced a new one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just mentioning at the beginning of the show for $189, and it's coming out late in August. And I don't
and
think
the
that's
other
the
one
price
is $139.
Yeah.
They have a
yeah,
brand new
amazing.
One for $139 that's just Wi-Fi, which is fabulous.
Right, right. So the thing is that I think that the price, they're getting close to the price point. I don't mean mine particularly. But and a lot of people have been discussing that this is not my particular idea, that it's not mine alone. But I think once they get down to about $89 or $90, they're gonna run off the shelves. They're not
yeah.
gonna be able to make them fast enough.
Yeah. Yes.
And the first company that does it, if the others resist, of course, are going to have an enormous competitive advantage.
Yeah.
But there are no other, I don't believe, no other equivalents to what Amazon is doing in the world of Barnes & Noble and Borders in terms of their readers. By readers, I mean their electronic readers, not their customers.
Yep.
They're being able to publish in the same way, are there, as far as you know?
You can get on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can get on Barnes & Noble through Smashwords, but it's quite clunky in their user interface. And the reporting system and payment system isn't nearly as nice
smooth.
As Amazon's.
Yeah, right.
Barnes & Noble coming out with a Pubit for authors who want to put their own books up, and it's a user interface like Amazon is using. And they have announced that will be out at the end of the summer. So,
great. It would be really nice if someone could go to barnesandnoble.com or to amazon.com, find your book in either case with a search.
Yeah.
But as of the moment, of course, Amazon is the 300-pound gorilla in the arena.
They really
the arena.
Are. They are.
Yeah. So Barnes & Noble ought to try to work a deal where they can access those books and sell them electronically in the same way, clearly, because otherwise, in a different context, you know, Yahoo in some parts of the world uses Google as the search engine for the searches done on Yahoo.
Yeah.
Okay, though not in the United States. And if Barnes & Noble were to do the equivalent, they'd obviously profit, as would Amazon, and as would the authors who are doing what you're doing, which I have to tell you, I don't know if you were the first, but you're the first one I heard of who's doing this. And I'm trying to avoid being overly enthusiastic because it sounds fabulous, again, for readers and writers alike.
Yes, definitely. Well, I was not the first, but I really followed in Joe Conrath's footsteps. He has a blog, and that's where he announced, you know, all his sales figures for his ebooks, and and he's a traditionally published author that had a backlist of out-of-print books that, you know, weren't making him a dime. So he decided to just put them all up on Amazon, and now he recently just turned down a publishing deal in order to self-publish on Kindle because they
Amazing.
Wanted to change his book, and he didn't want to change his book, so he decided to go the self-publishing route. And
you could see him holding up a finger on one of his hands.
Oh my goodness!
To that publisher from here.
Yes. I have no idea.
Yeah. But you know, it's one of the things that this does. One of the things it gives you the liberty to do, because it doesn't cost the writer anything, is to take the novel that is in that drawer.
Yes.
Okay. And put it up.
Definitely.
You know, it's really. I mean, it's really an opportunity. Of course, there's a bad side to that too. One of the things that traditional publishing does is it gets rid of the nuts who think they've written the great American novel. And you know, one of the things I'm overly fond of saying is that everyone who knows how to type thinks that means they know how to write.
That's true.
Yeah, but it really does give an opportunity. And with the excerpt, you can be your own, not the writer, but the reader can be their own editor and make a determination, just like you do in a bookstore, realistically.
Exactly.
I mean, nobody buys a book without picking it up and looking through it a little bit.
Exactly.
And,
That's so true.
Yeah. Well, listen, we've only got about 2 minutes, so in a moment or so I'm going to let you go, but I want to thank you because this has been thrilling. Do you have your own website for people to then latch on to and link to the book or not at this point?
Yes, I do. It's victorinelisky.com, and I'll spell that out. victorinelisky.com.
Okay. When next we talk, I'm going to find out how you got the name Victorine.
Oh!
That's for another time. I'd love to have you back on in a couple of months, see how the sales are going.
Sounds
and
great.
For anyone who wants to get a look at the book, that website that Vicki just gave us will allow you to get at it and then move on to, Kindleboards.com?
Yes, Kindleboards.com is the forum, and Amazon is where it's selling.
Right, so you can just go to Amazon.com if you want to look for the book. This, again, terrific. Best of luck to you. I know that you're going to have untold success. Seriously, I think you're going to do great in the coming months with the existing book, and the next book you'll do even better.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, Vicki, thanks very much. Take care.
Okay.
Talk to you soon. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
So that leaves you with just me for the moment. Thanks to Vicki, and I hope all of you enjoyed that at least as much as I did, because I thought that was, through no skill of the interviewer, a terrific, entertaining, and interesting discussion. And we are at the end of this episode. I invite you to join us next week when hopefully we'll have another interesting discussion. I'm sure we will. And you can join us at that time, or you can listen to us in archive. We'll be back next Thursday, 7:30 Pacific time. Hope you join us then. Same bad time, same bad station. Have a great week.